Excellent. Yeah, so we're going to be talking about the min entropy of classical quantum combs and some applications. I think Rob told me at one point when he was in Innsbruck that he doesn't like outline slides. So this is also my outline slide. We will talk first about the min entropy. I'll try and spend some time motivating it and saying what it is. I think that will lead us quite naturally to talk about classical quantum combs, and then we'll talk about what we can use these two things for after that. So I should be clear at the start. When I say the min entropy, I do actually mean the min conditional entropy or the conditional min entropy. It is conditional entropy. And I don't mean minimizing the Shannon or von Neumann entropy. So the min entropy itself is a different entropic term. I want to start motivating it by looking at the simple case where we have the min entropy for a state, rho AB, bipartite. And it's going to be conditional in the sense of we touch B and we want to find out something about A. So.
Sorry, Lucien Hardy says he still can't hear anything.
Okay.
Josh, are you hearing things?
So I've just been told that not everyone on Zoom can hear me. Can some people on Zoom hear me?
The mic is on, right?
Mic is on, as far as I'm aware.
I think I just left Argon.
I wonder if
Hear you fine.
Okay.
Is that fine?
One of the Zoom participants.
Okay.
Okay, so it sounds maybe only Lucien can't hear you, which could be, yeah.
Could
be just something on the Lucien system if everybody else.
Okay, maybe I just wait 2 minutes for Claire to come back and then continue? Or should I just power on?
Question. How many people do we have on Zoom? Are you on the Zoom?
I'm not.
is it town name? There's five.
We can confirm that other people.
So
that
he said that Lucien should restart his computer.
Oh, well,
restart Zoom, sorry.
Yeah. I see.
Okay, I don't know if.
Let me write that.
Okay, yeah.
I just wonder if there's anybody else on Zoom. Somebody seemed to weigh in that they could hear over Zoom.
Yeah. So please explain.
Yeah, I can hear now. Sorry about that.
Okay.
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 So maybe I just repeat the last thing I said. That so yes, we're talking about the min entropy, and we're going to motivate it from the sort of, I guess, minimal case, the state case. We have a bipartite state. And the way that this works is we act on B with some map that goes from B to A prime. A prime is a Hilbert space that's equivalent to the Hilbert space A, the isomorphic. We then compare the outputs using this thing, so it's an unnormalized maximally mixed state, a maximally entangled state, which is essentially just saying that we want the system that we get on A prime to be maximally correlated with the system on A. And that's the mathematical expression underneath. We then maximize over all possible maps of this type. And this is essentially what is a min entropy. So there is a logarithm that we have to apply, and that gives you the actual min entropy to have the quantity in bits. And it's that expression you see. Most of what I know about the min entropy, I take from this paper, which is nice because it gives you an operational meaning of what the min and max entropies are. So we have this, but I will mostly be talking about the thing inside the logarithm because, ultimately the logarithm is not that interesting. And just sets the units, and the thing inside is what we can then write as a semi-definite program, but I'll come to that a little bit later on.
Quick question.
Yep.
Is it conceivable that one could determine precisely what the optimal CP map is to minimize this quantity? Like, could it just be something as simple as, the thing that, such that, if I lump E together with the maximally entangled state of the end, corresponds to, rho A given B, just some formula like rho AB distorted by the marginal on B, or is it well known that this is a hard optimization problem? So,
I don't think it's necessarily a hard optimization problem, because we can write it as an SDP, for example, but I don't know if I could personally look at the state and tell you what the optimal map is.
Okay.
If that's
so, there might be a simple analytic expression for what the optimal map is potentially.
Yes, I don't know. Yeah.
All right,
yeah.
Good. Thanks.
Yeah. And yes, please feel free to stop me at any point with questions. I will restrict to this case. So instead of taking the full bipartite state where everything is quantum, we restrict to a classical quantum state. So we have, instead of A, I'm just going to write X for this classical random variable. And we essentially just have an ensemble of quantum states indexed by X. And we're trying to figure out which one it is. So this is very closely related to hypothesis testing. And that's something that I will lean on throughout this talk. I like this hypothesis testing view of the min entropy. So just to explain that further, you know, now that we have a classical thing, the channels are quantum to classical channels, they're POVMs, and we maximize over the POVMs to get some expression like this, where this delta x, x prime is just implementing this equivalent, like a checking of the output on both sides of this, the x and x prime. Of course, this trace
What does phi mean then, the green box at the end?
That's okay. That's, we don't need phi fully. We just need the diagonal of this operator in the case where it's classical. But I just leave it there as to be consistent with the previous slide. So usually, if I go back a slide, often you will see the min entropy two slides, I should say, where this phi operator at the end is not present, but they just identify immediately A and A prime. So they think about this map E going from B to A. But I personally like to add that there because firstly, it has a nice interpretation in terms of, you know, fidelity with a maximally entangled state. And I think it just works a bit nicer keeping track of all the different Hilbert spaces correctly. But that's my personal preference.
Thanks.
Yeah, so with this expression for the classical quantum state, this trace is just a conditional probability. And this whole thing then is some probability. And they call it the guessing probability in the literature. And I will sometimes use that terminology. And as I said before, I do want to lean on this whole like hypothesis testing perspective of the min entropy, that this is some measure of how distinguishable the states in our set of hypotheses is. Okay, so to ramp it up slightly, we will go to the case where instead of having states as hypotheses, we will have channels as hypotheses. So we have some ensemble of quantum channels. And I will start to use this sort of diagrammatic notation where the random variable, all of that information is stored up in this box, and the boxes down below are the hypotheses. If we want to try and think about what the min entropy is, we can do the naive thing where we put in some state and then we measure on the output and do this comparison again. But of course, this is not the full story because we may be able to use some entanglement to improve this measure. And so in fact, we need to optimize over three things. If we take this perspective, we have to optimize over some auxiliary space, some Hilbert on both spaces, some state on both Hilbert spaces, and a POVM on the output and the auxiliary space to give you that expression. If we then go to having two copies of each of our hypotheses, then again, this optimization thing gets just more and more complicated. It is known that this having two copies is there a question?
I think it was just a noise.
Okay. Having two copies of our hypotheses in the quantum channel case is interesting. It is significant because there are channels that are distinguishable with two copies that are not distinguishable with a single copy. And in particular, you need to have a sequential strategy to distinguish these hypotheses in this case. This is in this paper that's down below. So if we put up that expression that I've been writing a number of times, it gets more and more complicated if we have more and more channels, more and more copies of our channels.
Just two quick check.
Yeah.
Are sequential channels always more informative than parallel?
I don't know about always. I mean, if...
Okay, are you going to define the min entropy in terms of like for something which I have n copies of? Then I'm going to define it as n sequential copies as opposed to n parallel. Like, am I not allowed to talk about min entropy of n copies in terms of n parallel copies, or is it like just we're going to just make this convention, which is n sequential copies?
So are you asking whether the if I take this thing, if it's different to say the min entropy of two times the two times entropy of just having one copy? Is that your question?
Yes, because then I could imagine that I could sort of process them both using sort of like a, this map E would be sort of entangling unitary on the B coming from one and the B coming from the other. But I guess it already can be because the side channel R is arbitrary.
Yeah.
So, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Then, would there also be a well-defined notion of max entropy, where instead of talking about the like maximum likelihood of guessing correctly, it would be sort of the minimum error of guessing wrong?
So, I mean, the maximum probability of guessing correctly and the minimum error of guessing wrong
so
is...
You have this, like, quotes, like, how distinguishable are
yes.
the...
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So
the min entropy in that case so is closely related to this error. So there is a max entropy.
Yeah.
I'm not so familiar with it, and it's defined that there's some sort of like duality between the max entropy and the min entropy based on, I don't know, some like purification type thing, but I really don't know much about that. What you've just said about having the minimum error of guessing incorrectly, but I mean, this is just, if we take one minus the error of guessing correctly, you get the probability of guessing incorrectly, right? So it's one minus this expression. If you have if you treat all the different ways of being incorrect symmetrically.
Well, if I had, let's say, three things that I was distinguishing between.
Yeah.
Then I could add up the probability of correctly guessing one, correctly guessing the other, incorrectly guessing the other.
Yeah. And if you treat all of the other different ways of guessing, so if I guess that it's one, but it's actually two, and I guess that it's one, it's actually three, and so on. If you treat all of those the same, then these are related by just one minus. Yeah, and in fact, that's something that I'm looking into in a current project back in Innsbruck, where we're trying to make the notion with hypothesis testing really, really clear, and then prove some stuff. Yeah. Okay, so I think quite a few people here will be familiar with Combs. So really, you know, what I was just trying to motivate is that if we do this thing of maximizing over everything individually, the row AR, R, the maps E, etc., that gets quite cumbersome, and we can just do it by writing it all as a comb. So D here is everything in pink, and we can maximize over the set of combs. Well, in this case, I would call it a dual comb because ultimately I will be talking about the thing in blue as a comb, and the thing in pink is the dual comb in the sense of making sure that the Hilbert spaces match so that they fit together nicely to give you like a probability number.
The green is considered part of the dual comb, yes?
Yeah, you can consider it as part of the dual comb, you consider it as part of the blue comb. I don't really mind. Mostly in the literature, as I said before, it's not there, and we just consider the dual comb acting also on X instead of X prime. And I will also use that notation later on. Okay, so if we have two copies of the channel, we may as well go to the slightly more general thing where there's actually a wire going between them. And at that point, we should just be talking about combs and combs rather than channels and channels. Channels and combs. So I start to use this graphical notation. This thing in the bottom left-hand corner is what I write for our classical quantum combs. So it's just the classical variable and some set of combs indexed by that variable. And as I said in response to Rob, I will start using this notation for that whole maximization, where D now is actually acting on X instead of X prime. So we've combined that green part in. The green part will still appear in most of the diagrams. I did want to just say a few comments about combs, just in case there are people not so familiar with them. For me, a comb looks like this. Graphically, you know, it looks like a comb. We have all these wires, inputs and outputs. They are Hilbert spaces, and we take a specified time direction. So for me, left to right, and each wire is associated to a Hilbert space. So there's a wire, this wire at T0 is a Hilbert space, wire at T1 is a Hilbert space, and so on, up to Tn.
And are you presuming cones that have well-defined internal causal structure?
So I mean, later on we will talk about combs that have a causal structure, but at this point I'm just talking about positive semi-definite operator that has trace out conditions, which is what this slide's about.
But the comb is like, I think what Isaac calls a comb is the thing that you call the,
what did you say earlier?
Causally decomposable.
So what does causally decomposable mean in this case?
I think Rob is asking if it can have indefinite causal order.
So this is definite causal order, yeah. So I know it as combs or process tensor, and then the distinction with indefiniteness is process matrix for me. Yeah, so this is a positive semi-definite operator, and it has these trace out conditions where if you trace on the output wire of one box, you get sort of some other comb that's a bit smaller and some identity on the input wire of that same box. And you can just do that sequentially down. These conditions are nice because they are linear. These are linear constraints on an operator. And we'll see in the next slide that this is nice because we can write semi-definite programs with these things. So just to put up the full expression, in this case, the min entropy before when it was for the state, we had A and B. Now it's these last two Hilbert spaces, this last box of the comb, given all of the preceding stuff, and it's still the logarithm and the maximization. As I just mentioned, linear constraints are nice because we have semi-definite programs, and we also have a strong duality with the semi-definite program. So this is equivalent way of writing the same entropy, min entropy, using these minimums. And personally, in my experience with this thing, I found this easier to work with for analytical work, and also numerically. And then just while we're on notation, as I said, I will talk about classical quantum combs that are written like this, with this x variable. And this x variable, the Hilbert space associated to it, is what is output. So this is part of the Tn minus 1 in the above expression. So it's like, what do we still need to learn about x, given that we've interacted with that comb sigma x, or the ensembles of combs? Okay, so the reason why I think this line of inquiry is interesting is because at this point, I think we can start to hypothesis test structure. So previously, if your hypothesis testing, where your hypotheses are states or channels, those are very simple from a structural point of view. They're just like, typically just one map or one state preparation. Whereas here with combs, so we've sort of discussed, we can now talk about causal structure, and ultimately that's what I want to do with this thing. And we've done it a little bit, and we'll see in the next few slides some of the applications that touch on this, but I'd like to do it more properly. And so this is why it has its own slide. I want to this to be the take-home message of the seminar, that I think we can now do structural testing.
Can I ask why you're talking specifically about hypothesis testing as opposed to just estimation more generally? Because like in the context of a state, it was sort of like, oh, I can have a probability of guessing, which of these many states were prepared. Whereas a hypothesis test would be like, is it this state or not? It always has to be binary. So do you really mean like we can, estimate structure? Like it doesn't have to come in the form of a hypothesis test, does it?
So I guess why I don't use the term estimation is because I think of like quantum parameter estimation, where you have some continuous value and you get like close to it. So like in metrology or something. Whereas here I think of hypothesis testing as picking out of some set, which is not just binary. It could be multiple hypotheses. Which one is the correct one? And how well can we do that? So this project I mentioned before, where we're making this link to hypothesis testing as clear as possible and trying to prove some results there, that's actually started from a seminar I gave on this, where a colleague of mine who does metrology came up and said, hey, I think we can do like metrology things with this. But I would find that difficult because if we use this classical comb structure, the variable X being continuous variable, continuous valued, I think may, well, firstly, it makes it hard to do on a computer with an STP, and maybe it also changes some other things as well.
So you might be right to choose this terminology, but I just, from my perspective, hypothesis testing usually does come with a sort of notion of binary, whereas estimation, to my mind, doesn't necessarily come with the notion that the parameter you're estimating has to be continuous, like a discrete parameter or something I could estimate. But in any case, I know what you're saying now. So
Okay. Yeah, so again, I think because I now think about the min entropy as very closely related to like the Chernoff error, so symmetric hypothesis testing, that's stuck in my mind. Okay, so the applications that I've looked at so far are all related to measurement-based quantum computation. So we'll get a very lightning-fast introduction to measurement-based quantum computation in case people are not aware of it or not familiar with it. It consists of three things. So firstly, it consists of entanglement. And it's not important, but you know, some graph state, so G here is a graph, and we have some entangled state based on that. It consists of single qubit measurements. So I'm writing them, which I will use this notation later on, so I'll explain it a little bit. We have, you know, positive and negative outcomes of these single qubit measurements, and they're indexed by some alpha. So typically, when we do measurement-based quantum computation, you do these single qubit measurements in various axes of the Bloch sphere. So for concreteness, you can just think of this as being a measurement in the xy plane of the Bloch sphere, and that angle alpha is the angle made with the x axis. The final component that we need to get deterministic computation in this measurement-based way are corrections of measurements. So if we do a measurement and we receive the positive outcome, great. We don't need to correct. Our computation is proceeding as we would like. If we get the negative outcome, we do need to correct. And there are ways of doing that. That's quite nice. It's a significant part of what MBQC is, such that we get the deterministic thing at the end. So really, the computation is encoded, once you fix the graph state, in the alphas, so the angles that you measure in. And the corrections don't matter in the sense of changing the computation. That will give you any valid way of correcting will give you the same computation. But you just have to pick a valid way of correcting. The point of this slide is just to say that the corrections, the way we do corrections, is what gives us the structure in the following few slides. So I wanted to go just to a really basic example, and also because I wanted to talk briefly about rooted circuits, given some of the audience. It's something that I mentioned, I think, the other day to Ellie, and I just thought I would mention it because maybe we can have some discussions about it a little bit later on. So we're going to start with a very, very basic graph state. It's just two qubits prepared in the plus state, and we have a CZ gate between them. That gives you this graph state. And I'm going to measure that very first qubit, the one on the left. And imagine we get the positive outcome for some measurement indexed by alpha. So it does some unitary. So if we have this state actually not plus state or it's, you know, psi, some single qubit state, it teleports that state and acts on it via some unitary based on u on alpha. If we instead get the negative outcome, the one we didn't want, well, it actually does very similar rotation, similar unitary, but it's alpha plus pi, and this is important for later. I will split this just as u alpha and then some unitary w, because the way that the corrections work is we really just, once we get this w, you correct for it essentially by doing w dagger. So I just wanted to write this kind of in the rooted circuits picture. You do the measurement on the single thing. If you get the positive outcome, nothing happens, you go through this route. If you get the negative outcome, well, we have this other unwanted unitary, and we just reverse it to get back to the one that we wanted. For the next few slides, we're going to be talking about graph states of this form. So I didn't say it in a few slides ago, but usually you specify some nodes of your graph as being input and some nodes as being output for your computation. And the set of corrections, or the different ways you can correct, is based on these two things along with the graph itself. So we pick this one because it has some nice, this example, because it's sort of the minimal one that has some nice properties. And the different correction ways of correcting, I will write like this because they do have some partial order to them. Basically, if we measure the first qubit here and we get the wrong outcome, then we have to correct on qubit 2 and 4. If we then measure qubit 2, we have to correct on 3 and 4. So that's what these arrows mean. The influence is just if we need to correct, then that's where we do it. And the other labels, the X's and Z's, tell you what unit error you actually have to apply to do that correction. The point here is that we have some causal structure in this sense. In the paper, the preprint that we have on this, I was writing it in this way. Maybe I actually just put the next thing up as well, because I wanted to just make sure they're all on the same page. I think people here tend to write circuits in this sort of picture, and these are equivalent. So for me, time left to right on the left, and then time going up the page on the right, we have the, I guess, latent node. So here, actually, we're going to put the graph state in, which is some big entangled common cause and all of these things. And in each of the gaps, we're going to do the measurements. These are where the measurements happen. And you feed in your classical measurement outcome into the wires labeled C1 and C2. Then you have conditional corrections based on that.
So Isaac, before you go on, I feel like maybe that I don't quite see how this connects to the previous two slides. And it seems important.
Yeah. So this
A4 corresponds to the nodes 1 through 4.
Yeah.
And then when I intervene on A1, why can you tell me in the circuit language, why do I have an arrow only to the 2 and 4 nodes? Like, how do I see that from the circuit? Is it because that middle wire jumps over A3?
Yes, yeah. So this middle wire is not acting anything on A3.
Okay, C1 has an influence on A4 and it has an influence on A2, but not on A3.
Yeah.
And then the next one would be when I intervene on 2, that can influence 3 and 4.
There's a control qubit somewhere, and then there's after the dot, there's nothing left.
Yeah, so that's actually why it is the trace, which is why I put in this one that we do then trace out on it. So we don't actually need to know what these measurements are if we're doing the corrections. So we don't need these measurement statistics throughout the body of the circuit if we're doing the corrections in this way. But we do, like, ultimately, we want the corrections on the output state to give us the computation.
And I think, can you go back to your first slide before you put the circuits on? Just wondering, like, the specificity of which circuit you considered, is the language of this graph on the left enough to tell me that that's what the circuit ought to be?
So this graph has 15 different ways you can do corrections, which is sort of 15 different causal models associated to this. And this is sort of the point of this part, is if we kind of know that we have some box doing the correction, and this is the graph state that's relevant to that box, but we don't know which way it's correcting, can we learn which way it's correcting? So it's going to be trying to distinguish between the 15 different ways of doing those corrections. And to get the thing on the right from this, you need to, I don't think I have the reference on the slides, but there's this notion of generalized flow, G flow, which is a graphical property, or so a property of a graph, including input and output sets, that tells you when you can correct and also the method to correct. And there's various, you know, equivalent ones of these, if that makes sense.
Okay, so somebody has prepared the graph state, done measurements, gotten outcomes, implemented a specific correction procedure. Then you're saying, well, let's figure out if we can determine what procedure, but what's the data that we're given such that we're trying to figure out what the correction procedure was? Like, does it come in the form of here are the measurement outcomes they got, or what's the data?
So here I'm just assuming that, okay, imagine we get some box from a company that sells measurement-based quantum computation boxes, and we kind of want to probe it. So included in the box, on the label it says we were preparing this graph state and we're doing all the corrections, but it doesn't say which corrections.
Okay. And So we can
choose which measurements to do, and we get the output state, say.
And we get the output quantum state.
Yeah.
And we also get the outcomes of all the intermediate measurements.
Yeah, because that's in a. I don't think I have a picture in the slides, but in the paper we kind of like drew a. Maybe put the next thing up. We drew a gray line, and it kind of like doesn't include, so a gray outline of this thing, and it doesn't include each of these nodes, because that's where we can act. So one qubit comes out like into the lab, I hit it with a measurement, and then I submit the classical message back in. But the internal stuff is unknown to me.
That sounds different from what you said a moment ago. I thought what you were saying is that like inside the box that the manufacturers provided, measurements are in place in each of those slots.
No, I put in the measurements. I mean, we consider the restricted set of measurements that's relevant for these corrections to work and relevant for MBQC.
Okay.
But we also, so I mean.
So the manufacturer provides this blue cone. The problem you're interested in is by doing local measurements, I want to figure out, and by knowing what the state that was prepared before the blue cone, I want to figure out what the internal causal structure of this blue cone
is. Yeah.
And that blue comb is doing the correction part of things, right?
Yes.
You're feeding in the outcomes and it's doing correction. You want to sort of, what correction has it done?
Yeah.
Okay, and are you imagining that your probing scheme restricts itself to those measurements, which would give me a valid measurement-based quantum computation? Like it's just a plus minus measurement.
So
you're not going to do any other kind of probing scheme.
So no, originally we just write down literally the comb and put it into the min entropy and see what we can get out. So in the optimal case, what can we learn? We do also consider where we do that restriction to just, we kind of call them observations, where we have these measurements that fit with the MBQC formalism.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't have the results of the observational stuff in the slides, but I have the results of the general one in a few slides time. So maybe I can skip ahead there, because really all that I was saying in these next few is just that there are many of these different causal structures, and we write it down in this way. So this is our classical quantum comb. The classical variable is the, you know, set of all of these different ways of correcting. But we make two distinctions. So in the one on the left, we take all 15 of them. And in the one on the right, we take a specific subclass. So in fact, these 15 are split kind of into three subclasses and of five, based on which measurements you're allowed to do in the first one. So I said before that we typically do measurements in the XY plane, but you can also do YZ and XZ planes. And this is why we picked this example, because it's the minimal example where this node can be measured. I think it's the second one. Anyway, one of the two qubits can be measured in each of these three different planes, and there are ways to correct based on that. Also, I should explain why there's this one less than two here, because we restrict to one measurement plane on the one on the right, but also we remove one of the causal options, because there are some cases where the two different ways of correcting have a different partial order. So the one on the left, one before two, the one on the right, two before one. So if I write down the combs related to each of these, what I had in the blue a few slides ago with the circuit inside it, these are incompatible in the sense of this being a different ordering of how I do the measurements. If I keep track of, you know, qubit one, qubit two, when I take the comb of all 15, then we just essentially do a relabeling so that we do have a consistent order. And the results are as follows. If we take the one with all 15, then doing the min entropy, we get this guessing probability. So the uniform, I should say that our prior is uniform in each of these cases. So it gets up to 0.373, which is obviously much higher than the uniform thing. But the interesting thing, I think, is the one on the right, because maximum guessing probability is uniform. It's the same as our prior, which is 1/4. We had four different causal models, causal structures on the one on the right, and we can't do any better. And the reason why this is because if we take with these restrictions that I said, so the XY plane and also this only taking the 1 < 2 time ordering of those structures, each of the ways of correcting are related by a stabilizer of the graph state. So to go between the different corrections, it's like applying a stabilizer. And so then the ultimate effect for this specific graph state that's going in is like a common cause, they're equivalent. Okay, so that,
I understand what you're saying. Because I can map between the different correction schemes by just changing the state of the common cause, they could all be consistent with the same causal structure, and therefore there's no ability to detect differences in causal structure.
Yeah, so maybe I go back to... So if I go between this way of correcting and this one, those relate by a stabilizer of the graph state. So if I did this one, it's equivalent to acting on the graph state by a stabilizer and having done this one. And because stabilizer of the graph state is, it's the graph state again, we can't distinguish between these two. But it's for the very specific graph state common cause. So one thing I would like to do in the future is if we apply noise to the graph state, then see how much noise it takes for us to be able to like really distinguish between these things.
Is it at all analogous to the following? I just want to know if I'm thinking about this correctly. That like in classical causal modeling, I would sometimes say two distinct causal structures are in the same observational plume class. If the common causes are allowed to be arbitrary cardinality, simply because I can sort of simulate any distribution I could have had here by choosing the distribution of the common cause differently over here in this other causal structure. Because it feels like that. You're sort of saying, well, one causal structure can be simulated with another causal structure just by changing the nature of the common cause.
But in this case, the nature of the common cause is not changing because it's just being acted on by a stabilizer, which, the graph state is a fixed point of that stabilizer map. So if I apply the stabilizer to G, I get G back. So it's actually the same common cause in both cases.
I see, okay,
yeah.
I missed that.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of even stronger notion of equivalence than the usual one.
Yeah, I wanted to think about this in terms of observational equivalence classes, but firstly, it never really cropped up in the rest of the paper and I kind of left it, but I think there is a distinction here. Because also observational equivalence, you can change the common cause, right? Like you change that hidden distribution, whereas here we're not.
Got it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, that helps. Thank you.
Okay, so this was the end of the first MBQC application. Let me see what was it. And the second one we looked at was in the realm of blind quantum computation, which Claire and I have been talking about. So that's partly why it's in these slides. Just very conceptually, blind quantum computation is some protocol where some client that likely doesn't have much or any quantum capabilities interacts with a server who does have quantum capabilities such that the client can, remotely by proxy have a computation performed for them. But we don't want the server to know anything about what that computation was. Maybe it is valuable for the client or confidential. In this current case, it's something like this. We have our classical quantum comb where the classical thing, again, just indexes the different computations that are possible in this scheme. It's a finite set in this case. And the comb part of the classical quantum comb is the protocol that sort of encodes how that computation runs, how that interaction of communication between client and server proceeds. And mostly I'm taking it from this paper, which is a specific blind quantum computation protocol. So just to flash up on the slide, what we looked at a few slides ago, we have these, you know, plus and minus outcomes of the alpha measurement, and there has this relation with alpha plus pi. It means that the thing on the left, we can actually also write equivalently, because I should say alpha plus pi, it's up to mod 2 pi. The positive outcome for measuring in the alpha is the same as negative outcome measuring alpha plus pi. So there's some sort of like redundancy here. And this protocol uses this redundancy by saying, well, okay, instead of in the sort of typical MBQC case where we encode our computation in this string of angles at alpha, and we always want the positive outcomes, we encode it with some one-time pad, and we want different outcomes that the server doesn't know about. So the comb looks actually something like this. The alphas are a classical variable. The client knows what one-time pad and also what sort of corrections they use. Those corrections is very closely related to the ones before. I mean, essentially equivalent, but I've actually written this in a way where it's entirely classical. So all of the combs here are classical. And then we look at what results we can get out. So these are analytical results for the most part. In a single round, we can show that the min entropy of, so this is the how many more bits the server needs to learn about the computation that the client has chosen. This is bounded above zero. So it's actually some other bound in between, but I didn't think it was that important for the talk to put that bound in. But it's basically saying that after a single round, because of this like freedom of either alpha or alpha plus pi, there's no way that the server is going to know which of those two choices for each angle that the client wants.
Actually,
yep.
Go over that again, because I was expecting to see an entropic quantity telling you how much the server learns about the computation, which you would expect an upper bound. But you said this H min quantifies what extra they would need to learn.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's positive tells me that they need to know more. But how does that guarantee that they haven't learned something? Like I'm a bit confused about that.
So.
What exactly are you quantifying with this H min quantity? If you could just repeat that.
So if this is zero, then after interacting with the protocol, the server knows everything about which alpha.
Everything.
Yeah. And in this case, it's quantifying how much more uncertainty there is.
I see. So it's just saying they don't know everything.
They don't know everything. Yeah.
So it's not blind, but sort of not fully sighted to quantum computation, essentially, right? Like that. Have I got that right? Like
it's not fully what, sorry?
Again, you're establishing that the server can't learn everything about which computation.
Yeah, yeah.
That feels very far potentially from learning nothing.
Yes, and this is a good point, and it's a point that is about to make, because I'm not a cryptography person, but I think typically in the cryptography literature, they set quite a high bar for security, of course, which is that, you know, the adversary doesn't learn anything more than like the description length of the problem or something like this. Right. This is not the case here. So this protocol, this is essentially the conclusion that we come to, is not secure in that way, because it does leak information. It just doesn't leak all the information, and in fact, so for multiple rounds, for any M, it's still away from zero, but that's just saying that, okay, on the output qubits of the computation, we still have this one-time pad. So there's no way that the server is ever going to learn which angles really on those last qubits. So on all the previous ones, yeah, I can probably figure it out because there's like correlations between what one-time pad it uses for alpha 1 and then, you know, things that happen at alpha 10. But the ones that are always in the output, they're never going to learn this one-time pad. So there's always some uncertainty there, but it's not going to help me sleep quietly at night if I'm trying to use this service. Yeah. And furthermore on this point, we have an example. So these are analytical results. We have an example numerically, so some minimal case where between rounds, the min entropy does strictly decrease. So it is strictly losing information to the server between rounds. Okay, so I don't have much more. I only have a few more slides. This is to say that from now on, the footing is a little bit less secure. You know, up until now, it's stuff that I've thought a lot about. The remaining few slides are just some thoughts that I would like to share, and so we can discuss. I did say earlier that I would like to really go into this testing causal structure point of view, or estimating it, whichever terminology. So if we have our comb, which is essentially what we had for the MBQC case, where we were checking which causal structure was being implemented, we have a set of causal models. And I will start using the notation that I think is more common here. If all of these causal models have a compatible total order, so like these two examples where, okay, you know, X before Y before Z, or X as being a common cause of Y and Z, these things have a compatible total order, then this thing is a comb still, and we can use them in entropy as it is, or as I know it. So I think you know, this can go through fairly well. I would like to know how we can then, or you know, some property of these sigma CMs that tells me when they're distinguishable. I mean, I said earlier that we, for quantum states, the min entropy is a measure of distinguishability, and it's known that, you know, if we have states and they're orthogonal, then they're distinguishable, et cetera, et cetera. I would like to know what the equivalent thing is if we go up to these sort of more intricate operators. So this slide is just saying that, okay, people also know various results about this for quantum channels, but I don't know of any so far for you know, process matrices or combs. If anyone does, please let me know. I'd love to chat about it. And it would then be to do this causal structure testing. The references are just essentially for this. One on the left is for that middle line, and the one on the right is to say that there are people already doing some you know, testing of causal structure type thing. Yeah.
When you say you can use this hypothesis, you can use this to do hypothesis testing. You mean like you're encoding the possible causal structures in your process matrices, and then the result of that computation gives you with higher success probability, I guess, of this is the causal structure. Is this what you mean, or do you mean something more intrinsic of the structure of the comb itself?
So I mean really that we have some set of causal models. These causal models are instantiated as some comb. So we have some ensemble of combs, and we just have to pick which one is the correct one. Yeah. And yep.
So Moni, is a special case of this the thing that Katja Reed and I worked on, where you have a comb that has sort of one slot, A star, and an output B? And then you say, well, inside the comb, it could be one of two things, cause-effect influence from A star to B, or common cause between A and B.
So
it feels like that's a special case.
This is exactly what I wanted to do as like the starting point of this. So when I had a look at that paper, and at the conclusion of this one where we were, you know, doing min entropy for the MBQC stuff, that's actually what I wanted to start working on next, but then this other stuff with the hypothesis testing sort of cropped up in between. So yes, I think the answer to your question is yes, that is a specific case. It's probably the one that I would choose to look at first.
Yeah. If you have two cones with compatible total order,
yeah,
then you can say that there are cones and they're common duals, right? Like there are things that you can slot on both.
Yeah.
And so if you take a comb and a dual comb, you just get a probability, right?
Yeah.
I would think that we can do similar for states and for channels, which is say, like, if I have two cones and one dual comb, and if this dual comb gives me probability 1 for one of the combs and probability 0 for the other comb, then they're distinguishable. Or like maybe I need like to have like two dual combs, one which has probability 1 on 1 and 0, and then also vice versa. Because then I can say, yeah, this tells me it's definitely this, and not that, and this tells me it's definitely that, and not this, and it's not, right? Like this thing, if we have two states, how do I know the two states are orthogonal? Because I can find an effect,
yeah,
which is 100% on this and 0 on that, and vice versa.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Yes, but how do you know that you can always find this effect, right? So if I just give you the states themselves, you can check orthogonality and you know that you can find these effects. But what's the same thing for Combs here? I mean, so yes, there's the notion of the generalized instrument, and these are our effects in the Combs case, but I don't know if it goes directly through. Maybe it does. I'm not sure, but I just don't know. So like, if I just take these operators and check their orthogonality, I'm not sure if that's enough. Yeah.
Ali's question has made me realize that there might be quite a big difference between what you've described here and the project that Katja and I did years ago, which is that you're focused on kind of single shot discrimination, whereas we were interested in discrimination under tomography. So we were saying, oh, you've got lots of repetitions of the preparation of this comb, which you know is one of two things. Then you're allowed to calculate lots of statistics. And
yep.
The question is, can you tell them apart based on the statistics? Mm-hmm. Whereas I think from the rest of your talk, you were more interested in the case where you got one measurement you're doing, one sample of the comb. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, I also want to do like multi copies. So it's for the blind quantum computation case, we did have multiple copies of the protocol. Maybe I skimmed over that a bit too quickly. So this is something I would like to do. We get restricted very quickly by using SDPs, though. I mean, maybe I go forward, actually, because I talk about this a little bit in two slides. So if we have this thing, so like M copies of our causal model, I mean, if this thing has four qubit Hilbert spaces, and this is two, then okay. So counting dimensions, if we have m go to two, I think that's already too much for the computer that I have back in Innsbruck to handle. We really struggle to do anything more than like a single round numerically. So that was a problem. I mean, this can definitely be optimized a little bit. I know there are some papers that have nicer ways of doing SDPs up to some dimension that was definitely bigger than what we were doing, but we just didn't spend the time to sit down and do that.
Something I'm confused about that. In the section on blind quantum computation, you were reporting values of hmin, which I think of as having an interpretation as the probability of guessing correctly in a single shot. But then you said just now that you were actually doing tomography in the blind quantum computation case.
So I wasn't doing tomography. it was, okay, if we do interact with a single round of the protocol, what can we say? And then if we can interact with M rounds of the protocol, which M could be way less than what you need for tomography, what can we say?
I see. So that M is like how many repetitions.
Yeah. Yeah. So if the client doesn't change their behavior, in fact, in this case, they can change the way they correct and also the one-time pads in each round, but they don't change their computation. Then what can we learn?
Got it.
Yeah. And so I think this is, I mean, it's related to having like an intermediate regime in hypothesis testing. So away from asymptotics, I mean, like people do look at what happens when M goes to infinity, of course, but no experiment is infinite. So it makes sense to think about finite M, and this tool is useful up to some fairly small M, unfortunately, but I think it's still useful in that case.
So a brief comment, which is that the thing that has the most natural analog to the kinds of questions people ask in causal modeling is the asymptotic case. Causal modeling, you sort of imagine that you have the probability distribution, so an infinite number of samples.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the default problem that people work on.
So I would like to talk to you about a bit more about this because it's sort of cropped up a little bit in the discussion we had last Thursday in the group meeting. I would like to continue this because, you know, I mean, you have this paper where you test like the training and test loss for these causal models for the Bell scenario. And there you have finite statistics, right?
Right.
Yeah. So I'd like to discuss this more.
I wanted to check how many more slides do you have?
After the ones I had, like two, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'll go to, basically, this was just to say, well, if we don't have compatible total order, then this thing, I think, is not a comb. It's probably going to be something indefinite. Can we modify the min entropy to still use the same techniques? I would like to look at that. And then maybe I just go through this really quickly. So there's this paper by these authors that talk about objectivity coming from causal states, and it just came up in, I don't know, my field of view, and I haven't read it very closely, but I would like to think about it in this way, because they do something that's very similar to, well, they essentially have this quantum comb thing, but for quantum states, where the different copies of the state don't need to be exactly the same. And so I envisage this for the causal model case, where, you know, each observer of this, say, ontological causal structure have a different notion of what the lambda state is. So they have some different belief state going into this causal model, but the causal model itself is fixed. And again, they have to figure out which one it is out of a set. So just this last slide is just to go through a little bit about what is in that paper. So they have some theorem that says this. If you have this type of structure, which they call the spectrum broadcast structure for states, then you get objective existence. So it's, again, something looking very close to classical quantum states, where each copy is potentially different, and also for each tensor factor, there's orthogonality between the different ones. And they have these other things, which I'll just flash out quickly. I don't have a great intuition for what they really mean, but it's just sort of saying, yeah, if you have these things, then we get this structure, and if we have the structure, then we get objective existence. I would like to maybe think about something similar for the causal models case. So that's it. I'm done. Thank you very much for coming. And anyway.
All right. Thank you very much, Isaac, for a really interesting talk. I think topics of this talk is not like a normal paper, more like an entire conference. So
I don't know about that. Thank
very,
you.
Very interesting. Many topics to think about, and many kind of leads to potential future directions. So it's very interesting to hear about. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
Do we have any more questions? Quite a few already, but probably could have one or two more.
Maybe check with this one.
Yeah, it's someone online.
Nobody online has said anything. But if you can hear us, you may ask questions.
I do have a question, but I think it's a naive one. So I don't.
That's more than okay.
Ilya mentioned that there's a lot of problems with modeling in statistics, and particularly there are some models that are like the models that you don't know which, like you're in doubt of which causal structure you want to decide on, like your beliefs. So you say, okay, it could be both, and there might be like some discontinuity when you're checking if it's either one or another causal structure, and you're fine with both explanations. So I thought in the beginning of your talk that perhaps this might be somewhat related if you're looking at different possibilities, but then you accept in your hypothesis training or your thesis that some more than one correct outcome. And this could be like related to these sorts of discontinuous models, if you allow for more than one correct explanation.
So are you asking, like, can we use this formalism to have a case where instead of saying, okay, I pick one thing after interacting with the thing, I pick two? I'm not sure. I mean, potentially you could replace this, like, phi operator that does this comparison at the end with some other operator, and I've thought about that a little bit, but I don't really know.
Yeah,
what happens in that case?
What is your figure of merit to saying, okay, this is correct and this is not?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I know in the hypothesis testing crowd that there are people doing like, okay, instead of picking one hypothesis of a set, they will see whether it's in some subset of that set, which sounds quite similar to what you're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's completely classical one.
Yeah, so maybe I can make another comment on this as well, because I have thought a little bit about if we have So in this operator on the right, so the right-hand side of the tensor product sign, you actually have like some sum of operators that still normalize correctly. Whether you can relate this to this problem of saying it's one of these two, but I'm not sure if this is actually the correct way, because I think like taking this mixture of them is not really the same as saying it's one or the other. Yeah. I think it actually can kind of just like blur the thing, and then your problem becomes harder.
It's really attractive, the operational part of your research, because you can always research in SDPs and they're efficient and everything. So this might be a good way to motivate, because you can do hypothesis testing efficiently. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. So if there are no more questions, and I think we should thank Isaac again for a really nice, interesting talk. And that concludes the seminars for this academic year.